Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
And welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg. And this week on the show, it was sort of a week of deja vu. Meme stocks are back in the headline as shares of the movie theater chain AMC got pumped to the moon. And the markets-oriented geopolitical tensions are making news again as the Biden administration looks to potentially expand the number of Chinese companies that are blacklisted for U.S. investors. What should we make of all these flashbacks? We'll get into it with the chief investment officer for a hedge fund firm that manages $9 billion. But first, Charlie Pellett, tell us who this week's mystery co-host is.
This week's mystery co-host is Claire Ballantyne. Claire is a reporter for Bloomberg in New York, focused on ETFs. She hails from the same town in Tennessee as Dolly Parton. She's licensed to marry couples in New York, and she has a collection of alpaca paraphernalia.
Claire, there's a lot to unpack in that introduction, that Charlie Pellett introduction of you. Mainly, I wanted to get Charlie Pellett to say the words alpaca paraphernalia. I don't think I could say that five times fast, but you got to explain, how does one collect? What, first of all, what the heck is alpaca paraphernalia, and how does one become a collector? And what's the market like? Is it a hot market right now? What are prices going for in the alpaca paraphernalia market?
You know, I've been doing it for so long that I can't even remember the origin of it. It just sort of became a thing. And then what happens is when you have a thing, people always get you stuff like that for your birthday or for Christmas. So even long past when this would have died out eventually, it just kept going because people kept giving me towels and mugs and rugs. And suddenly my apartment is overtaken by alpacas.
That's hilarious. Have you ever owned an actual alpaca or no?
No, I want to. I want to get a standard poodle, the dog, because I think it looks a bit like an alpaca, but you can walk it on the street without getting weird looks.
All right. I don't know if you'd get a weird look with an alpaca. I don't know. There's only one way to find out. We'll have to test that thesis sometime.
But we should. I did one time see a guy in the East Village walking a pig. So anything in New York goes.
That's true. All right. Well, anything goes on this show. And we're very lucky this week to have a really interesting guest, someone I've read a lot about over the years. He is the chief investment officer at UBS O'Connor, which is the hedge fund division at UBS Asset Management. His name is Kevin Russell. Kevin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, Kevin, let's start with this whole revenge of the meme stocks that we're seeing in the market again. AMC particularly just going doubling on one session during the week. I mean, for a hedge fund guy like yourself with a lot of assets to sort of put to work, these type of things seem like kryptonite to me, especially obviously on the short side. I mean, we've heard a lot of widowmaker trades on the short side. But I'm wondering for you, you know, are there opportunities here for this? I mean, obviously, with the volatility and these eye-popping moves we've seen, it's hard to ignore for a guy like you. I'm just wondering if there are opportunities in this space. Is there any way for you to put money to work in this type of environment?
Yeah. So, I mean, we try to be about as far from these types of situations in the market as we possibly can. I talked to one of our PMs this morning and I said, I'd like to be roughly a million miles away from this. And he's like, well, you realize we're probably like 999,000 miles away because there's correlations with these stocks and other stocks that we're involved in. So I kind of acknowledge that. But, you know, to me, anytime you have stock price moves that are divorced from economic reality or corporate finance changes, that's like a flashing warning sign to us to really be cautious around it. And, you know, I don't know if you followed some of the stats on AMC. I'm drawn to it, not dissimilar to rubbernecking an accident on the freeway. but the numbers I saw were just amazing. You know, we had more AMC volume on Wednesday than we had in Tesla, Nvidia, Apple, and Amazon combined on one day. We had more AMC options trading than we had this little index called the S&P 500 index options trading. So, you know, the volume is alarming. And listen, I think there's this temptation to just completely dismiss this type of activity as irrational and illogical and a casino or a mem stock. And I don't think that's true at all. You know, to me, you really have to pay close attention to some of these phenomenons. And for a long time, you know, we analyze companies, we analyze fundamental changes at companies, we analyze what's going on in the economy, but we're honest and we're saying, you know, sometimes price performance, securities performance is a function of investor psychology and position and positioning. And, you know, when you have a situation like this, you know, you really cannot take an aggressive stand one way or another. You can't dismiss, you know, the stock price moves one way or another. You just have to be cautious and realize this has become a purely technical event. There's a whole bunch of investors here with different perspectives and psychologies. There's investors who are getting free popcorn at AMC theaters, by the way. That's a motivation. So
I always wondered if that's subject to the dividend tax. I don't know. Do you got to you got to give 15% of your popcorn back to the government, maybe?
Probably a slight markup at the counter. I agree with you.
Well, and then while this is all happening, I mean, are there any opportunities that you see for you all, or are there opportunities that maybe are getting overlooked because everyone is so focused on, you know, watching the meme stocks go up and down?
Yeah. So that's one of that's my 999,000 mile analogy, because, you know, when stocks, whether it's an AMC or a Bed Bath and Beyond go up, we see things that go up in sympathy with that. So for example, if people think that AMC and Bed Bath & Beyond are doing well, they get excited about mall owners or strip mall operators. And the reality is the dynamics of people going to malls and going to, you know, strip centers is not changing. It's not changing based on overnight price action in Bed Bath & Beyond or AMC. So we do see some of the stocks that are related react, and that's where we tend to look for opportunities to take advantage of the dislocation. So, you know, one of our core disciplines, and this has been, you know, for as long as I've been in the business, you have to be very mindful of how big the short base is in any stock. I always tell people stocks are log normally distributed, which is you invest $100 and you can lose $100, but you can make 10x or 20x your money. And subsequently, you have to be very mindful of the size and nature of your short positions. So we're always on top of that, but we're looking for things that are one or two step removed from these stories, take advantage of those dislocations.
Yeah, it always amazes me to, you know, if some stocks say 50% short interest, who's the one going in to turn it into 51 or 52%? That just seems like playing with fire to me.
You know what? I got to tell you, I totally agree with that. And listen, I think I learned this literally about 2 weeks into my job when I started 28 years ago, which is don't short too much of anything because it can be very technical. And listen, I think it's just a matter of hubris in a lot of cases. People are like, well, listen, you know, the valuation on these companies doesn't make sense, so I can be comfortable carrying a huge short. And, you know, when you have something that can be so technical, the valuation just doesn't matter. And so we're always cautious with that. We watch short interest ratios, call us old fashioned. We look at the short base relative to daily volume. We look at the short base relative to the free float. And if it gets above these, you know, certain metrics, we just try to avoid them.
Mm-hmm.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
Kevin, to move on to something I know you guys were involved with, at least earlier in the year, you were very bullish on China. I think one of the funds had was something like 18-20% exposure to China. I'm wondering, you know, do the sort of geopolitical sword rattling, the Biden blacklist, possibly being expanded to not just military linked firms. What do you make of all that? Is it kind of just that? Is it a bit of saber rattling? Do you see any real risk there of sort of a worsening relationship with China and an outright ban of more stocks for U.S. investors in China?
Yeah. So listen, I think big picture, there's a more constructive dialogue between the U.S. and China happening now than under the prior administration. And even though there's potentially a broader list of stocks that are going to be banned, there's potentially a tightening of existing bans and limiting bans to some of the specific subsidiaries. So, big picture, I think relations between the two countries from a trade and cooperation perspective are going to be improving. But, you know, to the extent that there are these bans, you know, I think they create opportunity more than risk. You know, I think if you're sitting here, you're sitting in the U.S., you're sitting in Western Europe, you unfortunately tend to think about this from a European or U.S. perspective, like, you know, the U.S. government is going to discipline, you know, the Chinese. But the reality is there's always a corollary, a Chinese perspective on these stories that creates, you know, an equally investable theme. And I'll just give you an example. So, you know, under the Trump administration, there was this real aggressive pressure on reducing higher end semiconductor equipment, materials, and telecom equipment and stocks to the Chinese. So what the Chinese government did is react uber rationally and said, okay, I get this. If there's some risk that I'm not going to be able to buy high quality intellectual property from the US, I'm going to build my own technology supply chain. And so while most people sat there in 2020 and said, wow, this uncertainty about US-China trade and tech supply chain makes me nervous, some of the best performing stocks in the world in 2020 were some of the domestically focused Chinese small and mid-cap technology and semiconductor stocks. So we always tell our investors, like, you know, don't use your, don't look at everything from your US lens. You know, put on your, you know, your China hat and interpret what this local corollary is going to be, because it's going to create an investable theme on the other side.
And how do you go about gauging that or trying to make predictions on what international relations are going to be like? I mean, you know, talking about how this administration seems like it will be have a more amenable relationship with China. How do you go about sort of gauging that and then also the time horizon for that?
Well, I mean, so there's a bunch of consultants, there's political research firms, there's analysts, there's policy analysts. You know, we talk to government officials as well. We can get, a really good sense for the direction of travel. And in particular, on China, we're leveraging our local presence. I mean, you know, this is why I would never think about investing, you know, in Asia from sitting here in the US. We have a team that's local, that's very plugged into what's going on in the regulatory landscape and economic policy landscape in China. The team's in Hong Kong and Singapore. There's resources in Shanghai as well. And you can get a really good sense for what the policy agenda there is and likely the, you know, the changes that are coming. So it's something you can get a pretty good handle on.
You know, Kevin, for years now, I guess one of the main bullish themes for China has been sort of this transition from a manufacturing dominated economy to potentially a more consumer dominated economy. And some of the interesting developments in China this year and late last year has been sort of an attempt to tame the credit markets in China, the, you know, corporate credits especially, and prevent them from getting out of hand, getting a little too frothy. So I'm just curious, you know, with those two things in mind and whatever else you're looking at in China, just what are sort of the main themes, the main kind of sectors? And is it equities and credit or a little both? What kind of things are really drawing you into China?
Yeah, so one of the things that makes us the most excited about China that I'm, you know, puzzled because it feels like not enough people are talking about is the aggressive market reform agenda passed by China late last year. That's, you know, the QFII and RQFII reform. And, you know, as you well know, historically, when we want to access the onshore market in China, we have to trade via the Connect system in Hong Kong. But what the QFII and RQFII reforms are going to allow us to do is to trade directly in the onshore market with Chinese banks and broker dealers. Additionally, there's going to be a borrow market that develops in the onshore market that's going to allow us to short stocks in the onshore market. So, you know, against all this anxiety about China, about a centrally planned economy, about trade friction, people are missing what we see as a watershed event of the market opening up and becoming more efficient and more accessible to international investors. And all of the same principles that we use to invest on a long short basis fundamentally in the US or in Europe, well, they hold also in China. It's just a lot less competitive. You know, in the Chinese market, just about 10% of the market cap is owned by hedge funds. The onshore market, approximately 80% of the volume in the onshore market is retail investors. And so we just have a market that's, you know, we think going to become a lot more efficient, a lot more conducive to relative value investing in a market where we don't think enough institutional investors are paying close enough attention. So for us, we like to think of it as China transitioning from a beta story to an alpha story, where it's going to matter the subsectors you pick. It's going to matter the management teams, the products, the sectors that you pick. It's not just going to be China as a beta trade anymore. And that just, you know, for us is super rational. And it's a really healthy growth in that market. From a subsector perspective, you know, where we, you know, there's a very clearly a tightening of the regulatory environment happening in China. There's some tightening of regulation on fintechs. There's a tightening of regulation on some of the internet and larger media companies. Now that's having a pretty meaningful impact. That's creating, I think, big opportunities in the financial services sector. You know, we see big opportunities in more of the cyclical industrial and machinery and material spaces in China. So it's kind of a rotation, not dissimilar to the rotation we're seeing everywhere else in the world, where you're going from, you know, from tech and growth to more value and cyclical sectors. But that's happening against a backdrop of a market getting more efficient. You know, for us, we see China as the biggest alpha opportunity in the world over the next really 5 to 7 years. And it's mostly to do with the fact that the markets are becoming more efficient.
Is there anything that surprised you in terms of your stance on China and sort of these positions that either this year or even more recently that you maybe didn't expect?
Yeah, well, I mean, it just, you know, so the feedback that we get, we talk to investors a lot. We talk to, you know, obviously our counterparties a lot. Yeah, I think people's eyes are just off the ball here. I mean, I think they just have it in their head that, you know, China's highly, you know, highly regulated, closed economy. There's a very standoff dynamic between the U.S. and China from a political or trade perspective. But again, it's not what's happening in reality. The market is undergoing this massive opening up, and to me, people are just kind of ignoring it, and they're getting caught in these headlines, and they're not paying close enough attention to the reality of what's happening. And I'll give you a stat that I think is pretty interesting. Right now, we estimate that you can short approximately $50 billion in aggregate of Chinese equities right now through current inventory and the Connect mechanism. If this onshore borrow market develops as we expect, that number is going to go up by a factor of, you know, at least 5x, maybe 10x. And what that means is, you know, China's already outstanding from a liquidity perspective. If you get that borrow market developing and it gets more efficient, it is just going to be a terrific place for dynamic relative value investors to deploy capital. And we think we're there sooner than most, but I think we're going to see a lot of people go in that direction.
Yeah, it's interesting. I often read about these sort of valuation discrepancies caused by the onshore connect. You know, there's a lot of money flowing in south to north, and you know, it causes, you know, stocks to be trading at wildly different valuations depending on, you know, where they're listed. I imagine that's a pretty fleeting opportunity, but a big one when it happens for like you said, the people that are there in place ready to take advantage of it.
Yeah, listen, it's a huge opportunity. You know, and I think you have to, again, resist the temptation of a lot of professional investors, you know, dismiss retail flows at your own peril, you know, we say, and it's not dissimilar to the mem stocks. You know, the Chinese retail investors have a heavy momentum quality, and you will see things overreact both directions. You need to follow it, you need to respect it, but it also creates a lot of dislocation and relative value investment opportunities for funds like us to capitalize on.
Yeah, I have a colleague, Yishi at Bloomberg, who, you know, follows the Chinese social media very carefully. He said one of the jokes going around when all GameStop and now AMC, when all that was going on, is that, well, here, America, you've turned into the Chinese market now with this heavy dominance of retail participation. Yeah. So it's going to be interesting, I think, when all of a sudden there is an opportunity to borrow a lot more of these names. Boy, I don't know. I don't know if Reddit is published in Mandarin yet or not, but that could be an interesting dynamic.
There's undoubtedly
Weibo or something. Yeah,
exactly. There's undoubtedly that sort of same chat room mentality.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
I guess just sort of relating to that, I mean, do you think that there are any lessons from that, you know, can be applicable to the U.S. market, just in terms of the retail presence, what you're seeing either in the two markets or any similarities or differences?
You know, I mean, maybe you can call me a little bit old fashioned, but, you know, we believe in being a little bit paranoid about, you know, making sure we know what we know, paranoid about what we don't know. And anytime you see stock prices or moves that look irrational, you know, that's just something to draw your interest in. You know, you've got to do a lot more work, again, on the technicals, on the positioning, on the expectation before you can become, you know, be prepared to come in and fade some of these moves. And listen, if I had one recommendation, you know, for people, it's to not dismiss these flows, to understand what that's telling you about market participants, what's that telling you about psychology, and then just be humble about it and say, like, okay, when I'm on the other side of these trades, or I want to take the other side of these trades because I don't think, you know, AMC is worth its current market cap. Well, guess what? The people buying AMC have no opinion on its market cap. So my assessment of coming in and looking at the value of AMC on a market cap relative to earnings power, which, you know, maybe is how we think it should be valued, it's just not relevant. So you just have to have this inherent paranoia or skepticism that there could be something else driving stock price performance, and you should be cautious about it.
You know, Kevin, I was reading about, I guess it was the first half of last year. You guys had a really strong run then during the pandemic. And one of the things I thought was really interesting was it sounds like you did some pair trades where you would short the stocks of some of the companies getting really hit hard by the pandemic, but then go long the credit of the same companies. And to me, it makes total. So I don't think I ever would have thought of that at the time, but it makes total sense given the dynamics at play at the time with the Fed basically saying it was going to backstop the credit markets. Another big story this week, obviously, is the Fed saying it's going to sort of unwind its credit holdings. And it was really, I think, more of a psychological effect on the credit markets than a sort of dollar for dollar impact from what the Fed did. So I'm just curious, you know, how you're thinking is, was that sort of a fleeting once in a lifetime opportunity to do that type of thing amid the pandemic? Or, you know, are credit markets such that you would still think of doing that type of trade in this environment a year later?
Yeah. So the opportunity in March and April of 2020 in the U.S. credit markets was historic. You know, really the only good analogy, I think, is the global financial crisis. And in particular, when the Fed came out and went the extra mile to say they were going to support the high yield market, we were staring at each other like, can you believe they just said that? Did they really just say that? It does say high yield bonds, right? Yeah, exactly. And there was a time where the market didn't react right away. And we were staring at each other like, this is a really unbelievable, historic, and special opportunity. And the most unique thing about it is that, you know, normally you see that sort of news and then the market squeezes up and you have a hard time buying anything and you're like, okay, well, I just missed it. But what happened for really the entirety of the summer, because the economic conditions associated with COVID were so severe, you actually had a bunch of companies who had to come out and issue high yield, investment grade, or convertible debt. So not only did you have this dynamic where the Fed was supporting the credit markets, and listen, I always tell people, like, if you had a wish list of things you wanted for the holidays and you asked for the Fed, they gave you all those things. And it's like, oh, by the way, we got a new car for you out in the driveway as well. So you had everything you could possibly have wanted, but then there was a ton of issuance. So we could go out and buy a lot of high yield investment grade and convertible bonds. So not only were we able to benefit from the, you know, from the Fed policy action, but we were able to benefit from corporates issuing in what retrospect was incredibly cheap paper to shore up their liquidity to operate over the COVID crisis. So, I mean, I'm trying to imagine how that particular fact pattern repeats. And I really can't.
Knock on wood. Let's hope. Let's hope not.
Yeah, and I feel a little bad because it was without a doubt probably the most compelling investing environment that I've seen in you know, really it really only compares to the global financial crisis in terms of the opportunity. So it's hard to imagine, you know, it's ever like that again. But listen, there are, and this is part of the reason why investors like ourselves, who we invest in equity markets and credit markets globally all day every day, not everybody does that. And so you can have situations where people are, you know, looking laser focused on the equity market or the credit market, and they're missing the dynamic. And, you know, probably one of the you know, we had some credit positions that really benefited from some of this retail participation, because as these company stocks rallied, they were able to issue equity, they're able to shore up their balance sheets, improve their credit. So it's just a really perfect dynamic to be long credit and short equity.
Yeah. And I wonder, you got to sort of be in the right position to take advantage of it. You know, if you're getting margin calls and you're getting outflows and all that, it's some opportunities for a lot of people just had to skip them, I imagine.
Yeah. Our philosophy is we're never that confident. So we're just never going to go into a situation over levered. We're always going to keep dry powder. And we're always going to, we always manage our betas very tightly. Again, we're a relative value fund. So, you know, when there's a market drawdown, we're going to be massively outperforming, you know, beta indices. And generally our investors are going to focus on their beta investments. So they're confident that we're going to be able to ride through those sort of events and capitalize on some of those dislocations. So, you know, when you have a long-term stable capital base and you're prudent from maintaining some excess margin, you can come in and take advantage of those opportunities. So we were fortunate to do that.
Well, and then just seeing what happened last year, I mean, you know, like we said, knock on wood, we're not going to have a repeat of that. But were there any sort of lessons from that trade or from kind of being able to identify that early that you're going to take into the future or even the next time there is any market turmoil or anything like that?
Yeah. So I think that one of the enduring lessons for us is that, you know, let's get our capital to the spots that are the most attractive. You know, I think there's one of the, you know, I'll call it a mistake, but maybe that's an overstatement. You know, people say, hey, I need to have some invested in this area of the market and that area of the market. And the reality is there were like, you know, yeah, the credit markets in the US were an enormous opportunity, but that was just, you know, frankly, one of three enormous opportunities in 2020. You know, most people don't remember or forgetting the fact that, well, China was approximately 3 to 4 months ahead of every other economy in the world in terms of getting the COVID you know, virus, but emerging from it. And so in our view, one of the biggest opportunities that we were able to capitalize on was moving into equities in China in the summer of 2020. Remember the summer of 2020 here, we were in the throes of anxiety in Western Europe and the US, but we were seeing very clear indications based on travel and commerce that the Chinese economy is starting to accelerate out of that. So we were able to rotate and really gross up our exposures in China and take care of that. And then finally, you know, we had that election back in November. And, you know, maybe it seems obvious now, but, you know, the Democratic agenda, Biden administration, Democratic Congress was going to lead to two things, stimulus and environmentally oriented policy. Right. And so that accelerated, in our opinion, a massive opportunity to rotate and move our capital into some of the cyclical sectors that had been ignored for really, you know, a long time. I mean, we'd spent almost 20 years when we thought about, hey, interest rates are low, growth is low, we're supposed to go buy, you know, high quality growth stocks and quality stocks. And now it's the opposite in a lot of ways. We're starting a new economic cycle. You're supposed to own cyclical stocks. You're supposed to own value stocks. And it was a very clear and obvious rotation that people should have been doing pretty much right into and after the election, but people lagged it. And that rotation, frankly, continues to go on even in the markets, you know, here today and Thursday.
You know, Kevin, before we get into the crazy things, I think someone passed a law somewhere where every interview like this has to include a question about inflation in 2021. I don't know. it's mandatory. I think I get locked up if I don't touch on it. But one thing I noticed, you know, everyone, not everyone, but a lot of people keep an eye on that Citi Economic Surprise Index, or there's other, you know, firms that have Eco Surprise Index. Citi also has an Inflation Surprise Index that, unfortunately, it only prices once a month at the end of the month. And I looked at it on the first day of June and noticed May. I mean, we all knew inflation was hot in May, and we all knew it was hotter than everyone expected. But that Inflation Surprise Index jumped, it like doubled in May, and it hit the highest level ever, which to me, I find interesting because the ripple effects of all the CPI and PCE, whatever reports we saw in May, yeah, the market didn't freak out too much about it, which to me leads me to believe that kind of the consensus out there is to agree with the Fed that this is all transitory, whether it be base effects or the supply bottlenecks we're seeing, and that we don't really have to worry about inflation. I'm just curious what your take on it is. I mean, is there, I don't know, a single digit chance that they're wrong, that we are looking at sort of a structurally higher inflation rate going forward because of all the stimulus? How are you thinking about it?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that a lot of people, forget is, we're getting this rush of economic activity after several years of really lower CapEx and investment on expectations that, growth was going to be low forever. And so, whether it's industrial metals or oil and gas, there has been a massive, underinvestment in CapEx really the past several years. And so now as the global economy starting to restart, the commodity markets are just really tight. And, the amount of price inflation happening just on the raw material side is massive. And now there's no shortage of resources in the world. There's just a shortage of resources that can get put into production right away. And so, we're definitely in the camp that we're going to see a supply reaction. You're going to get a reaction out of OPEC. You're going to get a reaction on some of the metal and mining companies, and you're going to offset some of those short-term price squeezes. But it's unclear to me whether that's happening in the second quarter, third quarter, or fourth quarter. And so I think there's a pretty significant probability that there's an inflation surprise and that it's difficult for the market on a short-term basis. That's over the sort of the three-month horizon. But I think longer term, I think there's generally consensus that there's going to be a supply response and offset some of these transitory pressures. So, what we're seeing, though, is, and I agree with you, there's, you have to talk about inflation every discussion. Otherwise, it's a problem. There's a really, I think, a rational transition happening in the market right now, as investors are starting to distinguish between who is more tightly managing their cost of goods sold, their inventory requirements. And so we're seeing who has pricing power. We're seeing, who's managing, their cost infrastructure better. And the market is actually distinguishing companies and subsectors based on how they're managing the cost side of their equation. So to us, it looks like we've transitioned from, if you were 10 out of 10 frenetic anxiety about inflation in March, you're probably down to like a 7 out of 10 now, because people, equity, once people are talking about it, for a good rule of thumb, if you've been hearing people talk about it for 2 weeks, it's discounted. And so for all of the hand wringing that's happened, if you guys are watching the 10-year, right? 10-year has been at 160 for, 3 weeks now, 4 weeks. So I think increasingly the markets are discounting these short-term inflationary pressures and are more relaxed about it. There's still going to be some rotations and volatility, but clearly it's the negative event in the market. It's the black swan event. There's an inflation surprise. It's the Fed is behind the curve. The ECB is behind the curve. And, it ends up being counterproductive to economic activity in the back half of the year. That's a probability. We think it's pretty low, but that's clearly the thing to worry about.
I keep thinking, as you mentioned, that supply side response, I just can't help but wonder if that's going to overreact. And we're talking about transitory deflation next year. And who's prepared for that? You know what I mean?
Well, hopefully I'll be able to come back and talk about that. I mean, listen, I think that there's no shortage of resources out there. It's just a function of, really structurally lower CapEx for the past couple of years. Their corporate boardrooms around the world, they're seeing this, they're seeing the opportunity, they're looking for new supply projects, they're bringing supply online, and it's going to offset. It's just a question of whether it gets here soon enough for some people in the market.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
Claire, as Kevin said, there's no shortage of supply of resources in the world. You know what? There's also not a shortage of crazy things, I believe.
I totally agree.
Well supplied in that arena. So I want you to kick us off with the craziest thing you saw this week.
So the craziest thing that I saw, we actually had a story out this morning. It was my colleague Katie Greifeld wrote it, and she's fantastic. But it, of course, is about AMC. And we saw that with AMC, It recently had a regulatory filing that landed this morning, and it talked about its intention to sell more than 11 million shares. But it had this acknowledgement in the language, and it said that the stock is at the mercy of the retail mania, with fundamentals playing little role in determining its valuation. So just the fact that that made its way into an official regulatory filing, I thought was pretty crazy.
Yeah. Proceeds from the sale will be deposited with Orville Redenbacher to pay for all that free popcorn, presumably. It is. I don't think we've had any of us have seen. I mean, I don't know. The bar for crazy things keeps getting raised higher and higher. This one, though, is pretty good. I don't know. I don't want to knock on wood. People listening with headphones at home might get a pop in the ear, but knock on wood. We don't get any crazier than that. But Kevin, how about you? You see anything crazy this week?
Well, I mean, am I going to get in trouble if I kind of copy Claire on this one?
Not at all. Not at all. No. All out, no.
So I saw something, and it was AMC, but it was an AMC nuance that I think is interesting here. I came in after the long weekend stupor that we all were in on Tuesday morning and saw that AMC had issued stock to a single investor. And call me old-fashioned, I'm used to companies issuing stock at a discount to last sale. And I saw that they issued stock at a premium to last sale to a single investor, about a 4 or 5% premium. And then I saw the stock promptly rally massively past that. And then that same investor came out in the afternoon and said he thought the stock was wildly overvalued.
Yep.
So we had this weird dynamic where a company issues stock at a premium to a single investor. That investor obviously sells it in the market that day, presumably, and then tells people he thinks it's overvalued before it promptly doubles again the next day.
Yeah. Right.
And you know, I think I've seen companies issue stock at a premium maybe once in my career. And it's just, again, one of those things where you know something's different is happening.
If someone can find the page in Graham and Dodd where this is all explained, I'd love to see it. But, well, and also I believe that investor was a distressed debt investor. So in a way, a brilliant trade, kind of the opposite of your trade last year. You know, it's go long the stock so that they can, you know, bolster the credit. I don't know. But such a risky thing because you really didn't know. I mean, who knows how the market would react to a secondary like that, I guess. But it all worked out in their favor.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, he obviously figured it out. It worked out well for him.
Yeah. Pretty good. Tip of the hat to that. I'm copying too. Mine, I guess we're all in the AMC. We're all in the theater together on this. I got to say, I did go back to an AMC theater last weekend and saw a movie. They have the big cushy leather recliners and they bring you the food. I don't know. Maybe there's a good bull case to be made. But to me, the promotions, Claire, you and I worked on this story a little bit together. The promotions going on of AMC are borderlining on the absurd. You know, you're seeing people on the street corner holding poster boards saying, you know, buy AMC stock. You're seeing someone tweeted a video of some pool party. It looked at some hotel. I don't know if you saw that.
I saw that. I did see
with
that.
These models in bikinis dancing around, waving, you know, signs that say AMC to the moon. I can't wrap my head around this, Kevin. I don't know. It's all fun while it lasts, I guess. It seems like sort of a game of musical chairs to some degree to see who's going to be left holding that bag, you know, by the end of this.
It'll end very badly for people on the long and short side of there. People are going to have issues with it for sure.
Yeah. I presumably those models got paid for their day's work though. So they're happy. It's some stimulus into the economy from all this anyway. But Claire Ballantyne, Kevin Russell, really great to catch up with both of you. I hope we can have you back, both of you back on this show someday, but I think that's all the time we have.
Thanks for having me, guys. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. Claire Ballantyne is at CFP_18. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. And thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.